Hello and welcome to a new episode of A Cornucopia of Tales and Tellers. Tonight we have six people in our Zoom room discussing and debating a point in question. So we're joined tonight by a group of tellers and or storytelling teachers. Can we go around the room and introduce ourselves? So Manuela, care to introduce yourself in 20 seconds or less?
I'll try my best, Alan. I'm a storytelling teacher, a teller, and an author for English as a Second Language. I use storytelling in various aspects of my work.
Thank you very much. Simona, we want to say hello.
Hello, I'm Simona, and you always hear me on the podcast, so I want to introduce myself. Next one, Jakey, would you like to go?
Hi, thanks, Simona. I'm Jackie Ross, and I come from Scotland. I'm a storyteller and publisher, and I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you very much. And Enedina, great to have you back.
Hi, I'm a storyteller from Sardinia, and I began to tell stories after many years of research in the folklore of my island.
Thank you very much. And last but not least, David Heathfield.
Hi, I'm David Heathfield. I'm from England, but I call myself a world storyteller because I tell stories from diverse cultures, stories from all around the world. And I'm also a teacher trainer, and what else am I? I write things about storytelling and creativity, mainly for teachers. Yeah, this is, I shouldn't preempt the question. This is a fascinating debate that we're about to have. What's it about?
Simona, would you like to tell everybody our reasons for being here tonight?
Of course. So as we said during the last episode, we wanted to do a debate / discussion about a topic that we came up with during the last episode. So if you haven't listened to it, I'll quickly say what's that about. So during the last episode, I told a story, an Italian story, an Italian folktale, about a peasant who asked a king to solve a riddle. And in this riddle, the peasant told the king how he used the four coins that he earned every day. And one of these coins he used for his wife, to buy food for his wife. And in the original version, the story said, the fourth coin I throw away. So meaning that the person he used the coin for was worthless. And so I felt the need to change the story, to adapt it to what I felt was right. And I changed it. And before I thought to change it in, I give the coin as a gift. And then I changed it into, I give the coin as a thank you, meaning that the person who received this coin was worth of the coin, so that the wife did something in return for this coin, and that she wasn't worthless, because I felt the story was a bit misogynist in this particular moment. And I felt the need to change it. So what I asked Alan was, did I do right? Could I change the story to adapt it to what I felt was right? Shouldn't I have changed it? And the whole question that emerged was, when can you change stories to adapt them to the audience or to adapt them to what you think, and to what extent is this something that you can do? And so that's the whole question. Mm-hmm. What I told Alan last time was that I felt that I could change the story as long as I stated that I was changing the story. But So this is the whole topic. We wanted to know what you think about it.
Okay, David?
Well, I just wanted to say, I think the question is a really big one, but it's also very much depends on context. So I think it depends on if I'm a storyteller, if I'm a folklorist, or I'm imagining most of us thinking as storytellers and many of us working in education. And I think it also depends on the nature of the story, whether it's a story from our own heritage or where the story comes from, whether it's a story that's considered very important to the culture the story comes from, maybe whether it even has some kind of sacred role in that culture. So I think the story you told, Simona, I think was an Italian folk tale.
Yes.
You are an Italian storyteller telling that story in English. And I don't think it was a sacred story that you were telling. I think it was a story for entertainment. For me, what you did is something I would do without even hesitating, to make it appropriate for an audience that I'm working with today. And I might only keep that original version, the misogynist version, if I want to make a point. And I'm contextualizing that and saying to the audience, look at the way women have been regarded in the past. So it would be for a very specific reason, which that would be very rare for me.
Okay. Thanks, David. Nice. And Jackie, you're nodding here.
Well, as usual, I think David's got a good point and summed up very nicely about the context. I think context is important. I learned a lot of stories from Stanley Robertson, who was a traveller, a keeper of lots of traditional Scottish stories. And, you know, he said we should always be true to the story. And he didn't like people changing them too much. So that is always in the back of my mind. So I think I would probably tell the traditional stories that Stanley gave me in the way that he told them. And if I wasn't comfortable with a story, then I wouldn't tell it. So that's probably how I would get round. But, you know, a lot of the stories he told me, I think, are reasonably timeless. But in other contexts, I will happily change a story or use a traditional story structure to create a completely new story. So, yeah.
Okay, quite interesting. And Adina, in Sardinia, would you have stories changed on you there? Or how would you...
Yes. I agree with David that it depends from the context and what you want to do. For example, as for the folklore of Scotland, is the same from Sardinia. I began to tell precisely to tell the same stories as old people told to me. So it was very important for me to tell the same story with the same words. A great master of Italian, an Italian storyteller, explained me in a workshop, be very careful. Even if you change a word, perhaps in this word, there is the deep meaning of the story. And she told us an example. So I always remember this, but on the other hand, storytelling and the tales are a river of constant change. If we want to renew and give new life to the stories, we are always change something. But we have to be very careful and to develop a very deep sensitivity, if I can or I cannot. For example, the topic is very important when we tell, as David told, when we tell stories from other cultures, if there's something strange, something that it's not in our, no? So we very easily change, in other words, no, we have to study very, very deep dead stories before to change.
Yeah, thank you. And Manuela?
Yes, I agree with most of what's already been said. I'd like to bring the perspective of the storyteller, but I think it depends very much on how you feel about it and, you know, what is this story, you know, what are you, I think in every story or tale, there is always wisdom to be found. And so old tales of our ancestors or in the storytelling of dark mysteries, romantic adventures, whatever, there's always something to be learned. And if I'm trying to transmit something, that story needs to become mine. In some way, in oral storytelling tradition, I tell you a story so that you can go and tell it back. And we don't have the words to remember, like Enidina was saying, you know, if it's being written, then and certain words are there for us the purpose, but very often in oral storytelling, that isn't the case. So I think there is this freedom of personalization. And maybe I learned something from the story and I want to transmit that lesson and you take something completely different from it. And I think this is the beauty of what happens. The story in the evolution of a story when it passes from one storyteller to the next. And so that, you know, what Enidina was saying about change, I think if you felt, Simona, that at that moment in time when you were telling this story that you needed to change that, it was something that was probably driving you within. And so what maybe if I was telling it, I don't feel so strongly about misogynism and what have you, and maybe I would have left it. I think it very much depends what we bring to the story as well. It's a two-way thing.
Yeah. I think it's quite interesting that I think it's sort of all four of you kind of picked up on it as well, where recently I did, well, not recently anymore, a couple of months ago, I did another course with Stephen O'Hara and Liz Weir, and they were always saying when you're choosing a story to tell, the story picks you, it's not the other way around. And David, I remember after our event at IATEFL, you and me were talking about there's certain stories I picked, like that night I told the fairy stories. I told a couple of fairy stories, but yet there's, you know, the big Irish mythological stories, as amazing as they are and as much as I love them, I don't think I would ever tell them because, well, at first, I don't think I could remember. But second, it's just not me. So is there a difference between like changing a story to make it yours and then changing a story to clean it? Or like, for example, we were all together, must be what, 2 years ago now, whereas I tried to tell a couple of Eamon Kelly stories and none of them felt remotely natural at all. But then I told a couple of Eddie Lennon stories and I was like, oh yeah, that's me. I can put my ness to it, if you know what I mean. And where's the line between cleaning it and putting your character out there, putting your, not spin on things, but definitely your personality, I suppose, on the story?
Well, one thing I wanted just to mention there, Alan, and I think you're in an interesting position because I think we've got a lovely balance of people in this room, and you fall between the two stools. Because I think I see Jackie and Enidina as very much tradition bearers. Jackie tells a lot of Doric stories from Scotland that are meaningful. She's inherited stories from Stanley Robertson, as she mentioned, and other Scottish storytellers. And Enidina's done a lot of research into Sardinian tales and is making those known. And I think as a tradition bearer, you're honouring that tradition. You're honouring as much as you can. And you too, Alan, are doing that. But the stories that you chose to tell at IATEFL were, I can't say tradition light is definitely the wrong word, but tradition adaptable, because you were telling them as if they happened to you. You were personalizing your experience and that connection. So maybe that's the difference between the stories you told about the fairies and if you told the
a story from Irish mythology, where you would feel an obligation to be very close to that tradition. And maybe you need to have a sense of being ready and having the necessary background in order to do that. Whereas maybe tell me if I'm wrong, but Simona, Manuela and I more come from the education perspective and are thinking of how we can apply storytelling in educational settings. And you do this as well, Alan. And we're often simplifying stories because we're teachers of English. We're we are mediators to help our students enjoy the story and at the same time learn another language. And important for all of us, and very important to me, is opening our students' minds and hearts to diverse cultures. So I need to be very respectful of the original story that I'm telling, and I try to be, that's what I strive to do, and acknowledge where the story comes from, but at the same time, that story, I want to convey it in such a way that it will be meaningful and understandable to the audience I'm telling it to. So I might need to explain some things, and there's that difficult choice, is where do I make the changes? How much do I make the changes? What kind of story am I telling? And very often there are stories that I love, but I don't tell them. I don't retell them because I think I can't change that element of the story that makes it politically incorrect, misogyny. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head there with Simona with talking about misogyny and sexism. That occurs so much in so many heritages. And I'm forever looking for stories with a strong female character where women have a voice. And often I'm either omitting those stories that are misogynist or I'm making alterations to them for the same reason that you did. And I think that's really is legitimate in the context light you gave where you're telling that traditional Italian story, because it worked. That when I heard if you listen to the last podcast, you'll hear it, and it worked. It worked beautifully. I would never have guessed even that that wasn't the traditional ending, and it kept the valuing of the wife, and I thought that was wonderful.
Jackie, I'm quite interested in how you tell your stories then, if it's would localized be the right word to say, traditional but also local.
Well, I think there's a mix of stories. I would say that I tell what I call traditional stories, and I would try and stay very true to what, how I was told them, or, my first experience of them. I also tell a lot of local stories based on local myth and legend or even historical tales. And very often then you've only got a fragment. So you've got lots of room to embellish and put your own spin on it. So I must admit, I do love those kind of storytellings. and then, also because I tell in schools as well, quite often I'll be creating stories to suit a theme that the class are doing. And then if I can find a traditional tale that I think is suitable and appropriate to the audience, I'll use it. Otherwise, I would take the structure of a traditional story and create one that fits. So it depends on the context that I'm telling in, I guess, what kind of story I would tell. But I do find it tricky sometimes because I love Jack tales. And I want to tell the Jack tales in the way I've been told them, and I don't want to change them. And I almost don't care if people don't get it, because it's something about tradition. I like tradition, and I feel there's something in there that we need to hold on to, even if I don't always understand what it is. So, yeah. Don't know if that answers your question, Alan.
That's brilliant. I'm quite interested to think, if you tell a Scottish tale that's from mythology in Scotland, have you ever got pushback from slightly changing a story? Like, has an audience member ever went, actually, no, that's not what happened, something else happened? Because, for example, in Ireland here, there's there's the Children of Lear. I probably would never tell the Children of Lear because I probably wouldn't be able to tell it without crying, let's be honest. But certain audiences want to hear that story as they know it because it's so well known from, say, you know, primary school age here. And if you were to change it, you would get told.
Okay, yeah. I think, I don't know if I tell any stories in that. I do think you Irish have definitely got well ahead of us in terms of these very strong mythical stories. I don't know much of the Celtic mythical stories, to be honest. You know, I'm a Northeast Scotland quine, so I don't get into them. They're very complicated. They're not my kind of thing. So I avoid that. So most of the local historical type things that I tell, a lot of people don't know them. So that's quite nice. Nobody's going to argue with me.
I like that idea. Just no one's going to argue. Yeah, why not? Yeah. Manuela, do you, with sort of mixing in the classes then, do you sort of mix and match with folklore and then say graded learners, graded lessons?
I've always like you said, I think the story finds me somehow and it seems to fit that purpose. I never look at the language. I don't believe that children or teenagers are interested in the language or the vocabulary or the grammar structures I'm going to use when I say once upon a time, or do you know what happened last week? If it's older learners, they're engaged, they want to know what happened, they want to know what happens to the characters. And in doing that, I'm promoting that positive attitude to not understanding everything, something that we struggle a lot in Italy. We want to understand every single word in a listening exercise because kids have been trained like that. So I don't really grade, I don't look at the grading, but I look at the appropriateness at the moment, the moment we're living in. So if there's been loss in schools or, you know, in families, and trying, I've always tried to find stories that uplift and give you that lightness that sometimes even our little ones need. They do seem to be immersed in playful activities, but we are living in difficult times, and I think stories have helped enormously. And I think after the course we did all together with David, I think I went a step further and using stories for telling, not just teaching. And I think that's hugely appreciated. Also by learners.
And Adina, in your research then, have you noticed changes through narratives, changes through time with, say, Sardinian or Italian folklore?
Yes, we are on the topic of misogynist tale. We are very sensitive to this theme now, no? We avoid, because we are tradition bearer, but also value bearers. We have to be careful to what the tales carry with them and to the listeners, young listeners. But it's a false idea to think that folklore is misogynist or not. Often tales have been changed in the time by not the tellers, but by publishers, other people, researchers. And for example, the story of Barba Blue is in English is Bluebird, you know,
Barba Blue. Bluebeard, or we also often call it Mr. Fox is a variation as well.
Yes. In Italian, Barba Blu is one of the most misogynist tale you can find. But when you do research, And you find in the folklore, Italian folklore, French folklore, you find the oldest version of this tale. You find that the heroine, the girl, freed herself by herself, not with the help of her brothers, as in the most known version. So if it's a false idea that in folklore we find misogynist tale and we have to make changes. We have to do research, and I think folklore is surprising. You find a lot of respect, a lot of strong women, as David said.
I think that's a really interesting point. I think so much of the folk stories that I tell and I read were published in the 19th century in England by British folklorists going around the world collecting stories at a time of where there was a great deal of sexism. So the versions of the stories we're hearing and finding out come from a particular period, but the original story comes from much further back. And I think that Anadina raises a very important point about the river of the flow of the stories always changing, and changing within each generation, but also changing within each storyteller's mouth as they're retold. I've got to. Can I come back to Manuela on something she said, Alan?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I find what you said extraordinary, Manuela. I've just come back from a week and a half of storytelling with children who were struggling with English, and I noted that as I was telling stories, I was modifying hugely the vocabulary I was using, because I believed otherwise they wouldn't have understood. And I know when I come back to England and I tell those same stories to a British audience, that I will tell them in a much, very, very different way, a much richer vocabulary. Aren't you, as an English teacher, even without knowing it, even without noticing it, instinctively, intuitively modifying the language all the time? Isn't that what we do?
And it's a shame, because they lose that richness. I've seen Goldilocks and the Three Bears published in the simple present. Now, can you imagine telling Goldilocks without saying, who's been eating my porridge? Of course, an Italian five-year-old learning English has no idea about the present perfect, but he's not going to stop the story and say, excuse me, what's that? Who's been? He's just going to hear that musicality. Who's been eating my porridge? Who's been sitting in my chair? When it gets to the time when he will be formally introduced to that tense, he will have heard it in context, and it won't be as challenging. So I don't know. Maybe we do tend to simplify. Maybe, but I would simplify more in paragraphs or the length of an utterance, I wouldn't simplify the language, because sometimes it takes away the musicality, the beauty of that story.
I would absolutely agree, and that's a wonderful example. Who's been eating my porridge? I mean, that would be a total sacrilege to take away the rhythm of that phrase. Yeah.
Actually, if I can come in, that's quite interesting, because I tell a lot of my stories in Doric, which is Northeast Scots. And, you know, that a lot of children that I'm telling to don't have Scots as their mother tongue. But the story carries the language quite well. And, you know, I absolutely agree, Manuela. You want that music. You want the feel, the sound, the texture of the language to come through. Yeah.
And lately I've been working with some Palestinian girls telling Palestinian folk tales. And I'm trying to introduce not just the pluricultural aspect that David was talking about earlier, but the plurilingual, bringing in, you know, The story is beautiful told in English, but what would it be like just to hear parts of it, or some, you know, a rhyme of it, like, you know, the rhyme that Simona was talking about in the Italian story? What would that feel like if I was to tell that rhyme in Italian? And then you gradually pick up that musicality as well. So this is my area of research now, I'm looking into, and not just telling a story in Italian and then telling it in English, that's translation, but immersing and using the repertoire of languages that's there, just to get a feel of what would it be like, you know, just to hear that two or three words or two or three utterances in the language of the original, if the story is Italian or Arabic or Irish. Even Chow, which we think is international, it's not necessarily in the Arab world. They know what when you use Chow. Yeah, I think it's a unique word in Italian that you use Chow to greet someone on arrival, but also to bid farewell in departure. So, these are those cultural things that we should be valuing and making our storytelling richer in a way.
Do you think then, with what you guys are saying about folklore, then are they time capsules? So how we're telling the story, when we're telling the story, are we setting a time capsule for what our culture is like right now in 2022? And will we look back 20 years from now and go, that'll change a little bit, or it has changed from, say, you know, the year 2000? Is our telling right now sort of putting into a time capsule how society is looking at these stories? Or are we going to be going in 20 years' time, we're going to be going, maybe change that another wee bit just to help it along? David, you're shaking your head.
No, it's that some storytellers might do that, but I personally don't enjoy putting modern features into stories. I don't refer to TVs or computers or aeroplanes very often when I'm telling a story. But that's not what you mean. Maybe the cultural values. That might be what's
so, yeah, sort of the more, but it, societal zeitgeist
as a time capsule, so much as a part of the continuum of that story through its journey and hopefully way into the future. But yeah, I'm sure there are features in my storytelling that in 50 years, maybe only in 20 years' time, people will look back and say, how could he have said that? How could he have used that phrase? I think one thing that's changing is choice of language. So not just of cultural values like misogyny, but also choice of language. I heard a discussion recently about uses of the word black in stories, because the word black is a very culturally loaded word. And we often talk in the traditional stories about the villain having had a black heart, and this being a very sensitive issue. And many storytellers are finding paraphrases to avoid the cultural loading of the word black and the association with a negative idea. So I think the use of the choice of language within a story is something we need to consider very carefully, as well as the notions, the ideas in a story.
Simona, your hands up.
So when would you use the traditional story as it is, and when would you change it? So we said, I think we all agreed that in some cases we can change stories, we can change the language, maybe some, not a whole part of a story, but a tiny bit, just to adapt it. But when would you never do it? Which are the contexts where you would tell the original version of the story?
For me, Irish mythology.
For me, Metamorphosis of Ovidio, the Latin poet Ovid, for example. I can't change the stories if sometimes, well, very often they are misogynist stories, but I can't change. It's mythology.
Yeah, probably stories that I wouldn't be telling anyway, actually, Simona, because I think that I think of them as the really big stories. And they're beyond me. I know someone who does a lot of like Norse sagas, and he does them word for word the same every time. That's just not a style of storytelling I would ever use myself. But, you know, I think there are certain traditions where that kind of approach is what's expected. Yeah.
I agree with Jackie. It's not the kind of story I would tell either. My stories tend to be quite short and leave space for, you know, a discussion after the story or interaction during the story. So it wouldn't be the kind of story I would go for. But I think anything that's been published, and if you are telling that story in a public space, that's when I probably would try to keep to the script, if there is a script. I tend to use or listen to stories and have stories passed to me. But if I'm reading, you know, if I've read a story and even if I'm making it my own, I tend to reference the author. I'm saying that I've adapted it, but if I was to tell that story in a theatre, then maybe it would be more correct to keep to the script, unless there's a very specific reason why I'm adapting it and why I'm, you know, changing content a bit.
Can I say something about mythology? I think mythology is very broad. And in the case, for example, of, you know, mythology that might be sacred, like Hindu mythology, I've learned my lesson there. I told a story once where I got a name wrong, and I was corrected, and I was put right, and that was correct, because if I'm going to tell a story from Hindu mythology, I need to be accurate and respectful of that, because that is a living religion and faith. Norse mythology, Jackie referred to, there are so many British storytellers who tell stories from Norse mythology. And some, like the example Jackie gave, may be very true to a certain tradition or version that they heard. But I've heard people retell Norse mythology tales with Loki and Thor in so many different ways. And some have been, I mean, if you were following that mythology in a kind of religious or a sacred, I think in Denmark, in Scandinavia, there are a few people who take that mythology very, very seriously and would call themselves adherents of that mythology as if it was a faith or a religion. But that's a very small minority. I think most people see that as a Northern European heritage, and there's license to play with it. So people really turn it on its head, will change, will put modern references in, change genders, and look at what happens in the movies as well, you know, take all sorts of license. And I think that's kind of okay for me, as long as that storyteller isn't pretending to do something that they're not. Like if they're telling you this is tradition, it's not traditional, then that would be dishonest. But I think there is license to play in certain kinds of mythology. I think so much of it's about personal choice. I personally tend to tell stories fairly traditionally. I like to stick close to the old tradition. I like to be telling it in a way that I imagine the story might have been told hundreds of years ago. But that's a personal choice, and that's what appeals to me. I don't usually like stories that have been adapted a lot to the modern era, but I don't think it's necessarily wrong to do it. I think it so much depends on the person and the context. But that, you know, but coming back to what I said earlier, if I'm telling a story from Hindu mythology, or if I'm telling a sacred story that's sacred to North American First Nation peoples, or Australian Aboriginal peoples, then I need to be extremely careful and possibly decide not to tell that story unless I feel that I have, I've been given that kind of permission. And even getting around, you know, this is a whole big other question that we could spend days debating of what is, when do we have permission to tell a story from a sacred tradition? Because even if one person from that tradition says, David, you can tell the story, does that really mean I've got permission? Don't I need to have somehow, this is an area for huge discussion, but the cultural appropriation question. But I think what we're talking about today is adapting folk tales and not the sacred stories, probably.
Then that brings up the whole other discussion of pronunciation of those other tales as well, and of characters. That's for another podcast. We'll have that discussion in the future.
Well, I went to a debate a few months ago, was it a year ago, and that was taken very seriously, and a number of Irish storytellers were complaining about storytellers. I think they were particularly referring to English storytellers who were mispronouncing the names of Irish characters from the mythology, and that was a very culturally sensitive area. So yeah, I mean, these are big questions, and it's not just about the stories. It's much more about wider politics, history, yes, colonialism, domination. There's big questions to be answered for, and British storytellers need to be incredibly conscious of that history, I think.
Do you think then, just based on that, for some of you guys that it matters to, do you think then your passport sometimes dictates what you tell, or do you have to be wary from time to time? Because, you know, David had mentioned like imperialism, and, you know, there are connotations, especially if, you know, if someone was to tell, you know, children a Lear in a different accent here, it might not be the most popular thing.
I love stories from other cultures, but I think over time I've tended to veer more towards telling Scottish stories, local stories. Not to say that I don't tell stories from other cultures, but that I would definitely steer clear of certain stories unless I had permission, wherever I got it from. And I would never attempt Irish stories, ever, ever, ever. Well, they're far too difficult.
They're also really hard to remember.
I want to ask Simona then, because Jackie said she would never tell Irish stories, but Simona, I've heard you tell a few different Irish stories. I know that they're very appealing to you. Do you feel comfortable telling Irish stories?
It's not really that I feel comfortable telling Irish stories. I like Irish stories. I've attempted quite a few, you're right, particularly Eamon Kelly's stories. I don't tell them as Eamon Kelly would tell them and as Alan would tell them. I tell them with my own style. About the cultural appropriation thing, I don't feel that I'm doing something bad, because first of all, I'm not English, so that's the main point, I guess. So I'm from a completely different culture. I like Irish culture, I mainly tell those stories because I'm teaching English, so with the English language goes the culture of the people who speak English. I feel okay when I tell stories from England, Scotland, Ireland, America, Australia and all the other countries who speak English, just because I'm giving my students an opportunity to experience the culture of those places through the stories I'm telling. I also tell those stories outside of the class, but that's a whole other story. It's because I'm not that conscious of this. I hope, Alan, you'll forgive me if I mispronounce names.
Well, I think that's the bit where, like David said, I sort of have a foot in both sort of areas, because like the English teacher in me kicks in, and it is, and I, you know, I see English teaching as I'm a facilitator of language learning. So that's where I'm trying to, you know, that's when it is, it does really feel like passing the parcel, as opposed to being aware of where it's from or what the story is telling. I am literally passing the parcel, you know, here's some knowledge, I'm giving it to the students. They could be six, they could be 65. So yeah, there's the teacher in me would take over if I was in the classroom, whereas it's a part of my identity outside the classroom.
But we can't separate the language learning from the intercultural learning.
I know, yeah. It's, you know, quite a...
We have to be aware of that when, mm-hmm. when we're telling the Irish story or the story from another culture.
I think it's more because most of my storytelling has been in the classroom more than anything, whereas it's only been 2022 where it's actually been to either native English speakers or not in a classroom as well, because of pandemics and all that as well. But I think that comes, I've been a teacher longer than being able to tell a tale.
Well, there is an element of me that believes that stories are for everybody, and that we don't own the stories, and therefore they are for us all. And I think we have to acknowledge cultural appropriation, et cetera, et cetera. But I have a deep belief that stories are there to be told because they have an important need to be told.
Yeah, I feel a world storyteller, and I feel comfortable telling stories from any part of the world where I have a connection, or where I have a student who's told me a story, or it's been in some way I've heard that story being told in a storytelling evening. So maybe it's my dual nationality as well, and I can easily, you know, if it's convenient to be Italian, I'm Italian. If it's convenient to be British, I'm British. So, and I think, you know, playing and not feeling strongly about one identity or the other actually opens you up to even, you know, I can tell a Scottish story. I have a Scottish aunt. I've heard the accent. I can give it a go. I wouldn't feel constrained. I'm aware that there are, you know, these important stories which I steer from, you know, mythology and other big published tales. But I feel that, as you said, Jackie, stories are for everyone. And as we become more and more international, I mean, even in this room, there are three or four nationalities. And there's only six of us mixed, you know, I bring two and I'm sure you all bring two or more than one, and even if it's just, you know, regional. So I don't know, I feel that we can claim that we are world storytellers. David, you're smart, you're not agreeing with me.
No, I enjoyed hearing what you had to say. I think I agree with you. I'm a huge fan of things that Enedina has written, especially in her book.
Piccolo Manuale di Storytelling.
Piccolo Manuale.
That's right.
And in that, you have many words of wisdom, and I've just got a strong feeling that you've got some words of wisdom to finish this session with.
I agree with this idea to finish this discussion with the idea of the gift, the idea of to share. The tales are there to share. They arrived to us because other shared. So this idea is the most important thing to remember when you are a storyteller. Create new communities. We are one world. Before there were little communities. Now we are big communities like this one. So we have to share always with very, we have to be very careful. The stories are, the tales are very fragile. But share is fundamental, to be generous and kind.
I think that's the perfect way to end. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much, everybody, for listening to your podcast. And a Gura Mila Mahagat to Manuela, Jackie, Enedina, and David for joining us for tonight's debate. Thank you very much, one and all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Grazie mille.
Ciao.
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 Grazie mille and gura mille mahagat to all of you. Thank you very much. So we will, Simona and myself, will be back in 2 weeks from now. Thank you very much, everybody.